board. Up.
I like your outfit.
Oh, thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Okay, we're on, this is the 16th, isn't it?
Yes.
16th of February. This.
Is that fine quarterly?
Oh, whatever's fine it is, yeah, I'm sure.
He wouldn't be worried if it wasn't fine.
That's right. Absolutely true. All right. We're in our subject matter of the post-exilic history of Israel. That is, what the heck happened to them after the Babylonian exile? And so we've been going through these six books to get all of that history. This is a little roadmap of how we went about it. We took them in chronological order, not necessarily in biblical order. And as we've gone through these, what will be six books before we're done, three historical books, Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther, and three prophetic books, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi, this is the order we took them in. And as we've gone through these, we've seen some fairly interesting characters, biblical characters, some of them delightful people, some of them not so much. I'm thinking of Haman, that sneaky rat that we saw in Esther. Ezra was a priest. He was a dedicated servant of God who cared about the spiritual health of his people. So he wanted to go back, and he wasn't in the first wave of builders. He was later, second wave, but his interest was in their spiritual health, and so he was going to try to help them in that regard. We saw the first two of God's Old Testament prophets that we see in our study here. Malachi will come later. These two was Haggai and Zechariah, two good men as well, men who served God and spoke for him to try to get the people up and going and get back to work on that temple. They got a good start on it, and then they faded away and did nothing. And those two guys got them moving again. And then we broke off of our study in Ezra again to the book of Esther. Queen Esther only became the queen of the Persian Empire, which extended from Ethiopia in Africa all the way over to India. She was a young Jewish girl, overseen by her guardian, Mordecai. And she became queen of the Persian Empire, and God used her and Mordecai to protect his people. A very vivid display of the sovereign care of God over his people, providential care, in the book of Esther. Back to Ezra to finish it up. And then we've come this morning to continue our study with the book of Nehemiah. Nehemiah was a very admirable character. He is, at the time of the book, he's the cupbearer for the king of the Persian Empire. He's the guy who stands between the king and him hitting the floor as being poisoned. Nehemiah, of course, drinks everything before the king does, and so that's how he guards him. So to be in that role, he has to be an honorable man, a trustworthy man. He's a Jew in the Persian Empire. And when Nehemiah learns of the condition of Jerusalem from his brothers who came to visit from there, physical brothers, I think, he determines that he wants to go back and improve that situation. The wall is torn down, the gates are burned, it's just a disaster, it's a rubble heap. And he determines that he can help his people by going back there, give up his cushiony job in the Persian Empire, and go back and help them by rebuilding that wall around Jerusalem so the city can then be rebuilt safely and so on. Now he, I don't know where he learned his building skills, why he thinks that he can do that. He obviously can, we'll see in a minute, he obviously can, but he's a patriot. It really upset him that his countrymen and his city, which I don't think he ever saw. Remember the timing of all this stuff. It's too late in the game for Nehemiah to have been there. Jerusalem was destroyed essentially in about 586 BC. by Nebuchadnezzar, and Nehemiah is down here in 444. I don't think the guy's 125, 130 years old, so I don't think he's ever seen the city. But he has determined that he wants to go back and help rebuild that wall and get that city up and going again. So he asked the king if he could have a little leave of absence to go do that. And the king said, yeah, you can do that. When you coming back? And he gave him a date and everything worked. And so he left that cushiony life and job in Persia, made that arduous journey of about 3.5 months, which can't be easy back in those days. I mean, you had to carry your house on your back, collect water and wood and all the stuff you need for living as you go. But he did. And he went back and he kind of eased into the place without a lot of fanfare or anything like that, so he could go out at night and sort of check out the condition of the wall and see how bad it was and start to size the job of rebuilding this sucker. So he's gone back and he has done a little survey of the wall, and it's the darkened part that you see here that was the wall in his day. The wall had 12 gates, and the gates, you know, you don't knock the stone, you knock the stones into little pieces maybe, but the gates you just burn. So it's a combination of rubble with some burnt stones and a bunch of burnt gates. So if you can imagine that pile of rubble with ashes, well, no ashes, but whatever the residue is from being burned 120 years ago, he's going to try to rebuild it. That's the task. He went out and kind of surveyed and he thought, this thing's a mess. It's going to take some work by a lot of people to get this thing rebuilt. So Nehemiah has dedicated himself to his people, to God's people, in trying to rebuild that wall. So once the wall's up, then they can start rebuilding the city inside the wall, and it'd be relatively safe. This was the old wall. I don't know where... Anybody been over there know where the Wailing Wall is? You got any references for that anywhere? So it's the part of the old wall then, the Wailing Wall is, not the new one.
Well,
part of this old one.
Technically, the base of the temple, the area.
Okay, so it's maybe somewhere right along in through here then, maybe.
Yeah. On the other side of that, yeah.
So it's this part that Nehemiah is concerned with. The other part came later. And so, chapter 3, we're going to start getting after it. So he's looked at the wall, he knows what a mess it is, and in chapter 3 he starts putting together at least 10 work teams, maybe more. I can count 10 in chapter 3. There's 12 walls, and so maybe he didn't give us every work team. Maybe some of the teams absorbed that as they went. I don't know exactly what happens. But in chapter 3, we have Nehemiah putting together at least 10 different work teams to start rebuilding that wall.
How did he know all these people if he didn't live there?
Well, some of them I think will be kind of priesthood and people like that, that he can kind of step right into that. But it's a good question, because clearly these people are motivated to work. And who is this guy? This guy comes down from the Persian Empire and he wants to rebuild a wall, and we kind of like to help him out, but do we dare trust him or whatever? So let's look at a little bit of this. We don't need to read everybody's name, because I'll screw them up if we do. Then Eliashib, the high priest, who was there, arose with his brothers, the priest, and built the sheep gate. So the first team that we get mentioned here is going to start their work up here at the sheep gate, upper right-hand corner. See it up there? The high priest and some of his buds are going to work this area here. I don't know how far they go either side of the gate with the stonework, but they're going to start working that corner up there. So right away, you get a team of priests doing this. And they consecrated it and hung its doors. They consecrated the wall of the Tower of the Hundred and the Tower of the Hananel. So those two towers across there, you see, in that northeast corner, these people handle. Then the sons of this other guy built the fish gate. And they laid its beams and hung its doors with its bolts and bars. And so that area is covered. But some people didn't join in. Verse 5, the Tekoites made repairs, but their nobles did not support the work of their masters. We'll see why here in a little bit. I think there is some intimidation still going on by God's enemies, and some people decided they're not going to join into this task. Verse 6, there's another team going to build the Old Gate. And in verse 13, some people are named to build the Valley Gate. Oh, here's a good team. Verse 14, they get to build a refuse gate. Yikes, lots of fun that is. Hope the wind's blowing north to south on that day, or that 52 day. Verse 15, the fountain gate team is put together. Verse 26, the water gate. Verse 28, the horse gate. Verse 29, the east gate. The inspection gate, verse 31. So what he's done, the approach that Nehemiah has taken and where he learned this technique, who knows? I mean, being a cupbearer, you wouldn't think you'd know Jack about building. No pun intended there, Jack. But it's a good idea. What he's done is he's paralleled these efforts. Rather than build one team that just kind of moves around the whole thing, he's got 10 or 12 different teams starting the work all at once, and everybody's working at one time, you know, trying to get their walls to grow and their gates and everything all at once. So the whole thing is moving in parallel. Good idea. Nehemiah had a good idea. As compared to putting together one sort of super team or special team that starts in a corner and has to work all the way around that thing. Now, stop me if you've heard this before. It came about when Sanballat heard that we were rebuilding the wall. He became furious and very angry and mocked the Jews. Oh, wow, somebody is opposing the work of God. I'm shocked and amazed. I imagine Nehemiah wasn't either. Probably wasn't shocked, wasn't amazed. He probably expected this. Who wouldn't? And Sanballat is the governor of Samaria. And he doesn't like the fact that these Jews have come back close to his land and are doing well rebuilding this city. So he spoke in the presence of his brothers and the wealthy men of Samaria and said, "What are these feeble Jews doing? Are they going to restore it for themselves? Can they offer sacrifices? Can they finish in a day?" Well, it doesn't have to be done in a day. That's a little bit crazy. "Can they revive the stones from the dusty rubble, even the burned ones? Where are they going to get their materials? Some of the stones would probably be usable. Pick them up, clean them off, and use them again. Some of them may be burned to the point where they're not, you know, they're too brittle, they're not safe, you wouldn't want to use them in a wall. But they think they can't get materials there." Now, Tobiah the Ammonite was near him, and he said, "Well, even what they are building, if a fox would jump on it, he would break their stone wall down." Wow, this thing couldn't stop a 10 or 15 pound fox from jumping on the thing and knocking it down. Just ridiculing them as much as they can and mocking them. So Nehemiah goes to the Lord in prayer, verse 4, "Hear, O God, how we are despised. Return their reproach on their own heads and give them up for plunder in a land of captivity." The Nehemiah is praying for some pretty rough stuff to happen to these people that are mocking God's work, isn't he? "Don't forgive their iniquity, and let not their sin be blotted out before thee, for they have demoralized the builders." These people are stopping your work, God. So punish them, is his prayer. So we built the wall, and the whole wall was joined together to half its height, for the people had a mind to work. So my gosh, these multiple teams working in parallel get the whole wall joined together to half of its height. I don't know what that is. Probably 6 feet, maybe something like that, 6 or 7. The total height is probably, I don't know, 10, 12, 14 feet, something like that. I'm just guessing. I have no idea. But it's got to be high enough that an army can't just walk up there and jump over the thing. So, in spite of the satanic opposition, which is ever present, you have to expect that. If you're going to serve the Lord in any capacity at all, you have to expect satanic opposition in various forms. And that's what Nehemiah is going to be facing here as he goes on. So, mockery didn't stop them. They're continuing to pray, and they're continuing to work. That sounds like a pretty good recipe to me, doesn't it to you? Human effort, doing what they can, and praying to God for His help and support. That package, that combo, is the right one for success. We do all we can, and we ask God to do what we can't. And between Him and us, things can get done, and they usually do. So verse 7, it came about when Sanballat, Tobiah, the Arabs and Ammonites and the Ashdodites heard that the repair of the walls of Jerusalem went on and that the breaches began to be closed, they were very angry. Why? Because that will make the place safe. They don't want the Jews to be safe. And all of them conspired together to come and fight against Jerusalem and to cause a disturbance in it. So these guys are now actually going beyond mocking to physical fighting them, trying to stop them by force. That is, the Samaritans are trying to stop the Jews by force. But again, the combo is one hard to overcome. We prayed to our God, and because of them, we set up a guard against them day and night. So they asked God to protect them, but they did what they could do. They set up a guard. Human element combined with divine assistance can produce success. Now, it can be done by God alone, but He uses people oftentimes to accomplish His will. So thus in Judah it was said, the strength of the burden bearers is failing, yet there is much rubbish, and we ourselves are unable to rebuild the wall. And our enemy said, they will not know or see until we come among them and kill them and put a stop to the work. So we're just going to kind of ambush the activity. We're going to sneak up on them and try to kill them. So Nehemiah's response to that threat is, I stationed men in the lowest parts of the space behind the wall, the exposed places, and I stationed the people in families with their swords, spears, and bows. So he arms his workforce and stations them in places where the work was going on. And when I saw their fear, I rose and spoke to the nobles, the officials, and the rest of the people, do not be afraid of them. Remember the Lord, who is great and awesome, and fight for your brothers, your sons, your daughters, your wives, and your houses. What would they have done, I wonder, if Nehemiah hadn't been there and been encouraging them and so on? What happened to the temple when they were intimidated by God's enemies? They shut it down, didn't they? For 15 years or so, nothing happened. That's why he had to send Haggai and Zechariah there to get the people going again. Without this kind of leadership, without the dedication of this man, I fear the same thing would have happened. They'd have quit. But Nehemiah intercedes on their behalf, encourages them, gets their focus on the Lord, and tells them to fight for their families, and with God's help, they'll be successful. So it happened when our enemies heard that it was known to us that God had frustrated their plan, then all of us returned to the wall, each one to his work. And it came about from that day on that half of my servants carried on the work, while half of them held the spears, the shields, the bows, the breastplates, and the captains were behind the whole house of Judah. So what he's done is, as I say, he's divided his workforce into sort of worker bees, and military types, guys who can fight and guys who can build. Those who were rebuilding the wall and those who carried burdens took their load with one hand and the work to the work and the other holding a weapon. So they got their bow in one hand and they're carrying a big bag of rocks in the other, and they're just armed workers doing all they can while still asking for God's oversight and help. Again, it would be real easy if you were a worker bee that when Nehemiah come and said, arm yourselves and keep on working, it'd be real easy to go home with it. You say, Nehemiah, are you crazy? I'm out of here. But this guy was able to motivate the people and encourage him and keep them working. He's the right man for this job, surprisingly enough. Those who were building the wall, we read that verse 18. As for the builders, each wore his sword girded at his side as he built, while the trumpeter stood near me. The trumpeter is going to alert them to danger if there is any, so he's standing close to Nehemiah to get the order to everybody get together at some meeting place or something like that for the fight. And I said to the nobles, the officials, and the rest of the people, the work is great and extensive, and we are separated on the wall from one another. It's big enough that the work teams are not right together, suitable to beat back some kind of an attack or something like that. So he says, at whatever place you hear the sound of the trumpet, rally to us there. Our God will fight for us. So if you hear my guys blowing the trumpet, all of you guys drop your working tools and bring your weapons and come and meet at this place, and God will fight for us, and we will fight our enemies at the same time. So we carried on the work, with half of them holding spears from dawn until the stars appeared all day. At that time I also said to the people, let each man with his servant spend the night within Jerusalem, so that there may be a guard for us by night and a laborer by day. So anybody that could, spend the night in Jerusalem. Stay there. Sleep in the city, inside the wall that we're trying to rebuild. So neither I, my brothers, my servants, nor the men of the guard who followed me, none of us removed our clothes, even took his weapon, or each took his weapon even to the water. So if you took a water break, to maybe bathe a little bit or something, or to get some water to drink or whatever, just keep your weapon on you. So these guys are armed at all times to do this job. Good move on the part of Nehemiah. I guess he wasn't as woke as some of his peers, so he kept his weapons on him. Good for him. Now, these guys are not going to give up easily. The enemies aren't. They never do. Now, there was a great outcry of the people and their wives against their Jewish brothers, for there were those who said, we, our sons, and our daughters are many, therefore let us get grain and we may eat and live. There's some kind of a economic distress that took place. It isn't said that it was during the time the wall was rebuilt or if it was just around that time. Apparently it impacted the build a little bit at least. But people are having trouble making ends meet economically. They can't get food. They can't get grain so that they can eat. Others were saying, hey, we're mortgaging our fields, our vineyards, and our houses that we might get grain because of the famine. So they're having to take out mortgages on what they do have to try to get enough grain to have food. So they're going in debt to eat. There are those who were said, we have borrowed money for the king's tax on our fields and our vineyards. So to just pay the tax on their property, they had to borrow money. And the way that they had to borrow is not good. And now our flesh is like the flesh of our brothers, our children like their children. Yet behold, we're forcing our sons and our daughters to be slaves, and some of our daughters are forced into bondage already, and we're helpless because our fields and our vineyards belong to others. So they're struggling, mortgaging anything that they had, their children, their property, whatever the case may be. And Nehemiah's reaction to that, verse 6, is, I was very angry when I heard their outcry in these words. That really chapped him off. And we'll see why here in just a minute. I consulted with myself and contended with the nobles and the rulers and said to them, you are exacting usury each from your brother. Therefore, I held a great assembly against him. People, some Jews were loaning money to other Jews at exorbitant interest profit payments, usury, and putting these people in a major bind. Therefore, I held a great assembly against him, and I said to them, we, according to our ability, have redeemed our Jewish brothers who you sold to the nations. Now, Nehemiah is trying to the best that he can afford to buy back Jewish slaves that have already been sold to other Gentile peoples and so on to raise money. He's trying to buy those people back. Now, he's probably semi-wealthy, if not wealthy, but he can't buy back everybody. Now, would you even sell your brothers that they may be sold to us? You're selling your brothers to these people, and I'm going over to those people and trying to buy them back. And they were silent. They could not find a word to say. That would be pretty shaming, wouldn't it? Go to somebody and say, look, you sold your daughter to this family over here, this Gentile family, and I bought her back. So they should be ashamed of themselves. So he's dumping on them for that. Again, I said, the thing which you're doing is not good. Should you not walk in the fear of our God because of the reproach of the nations, our enemies? You're making money using usury principles of your own people. And I, likewise, and my brothers and my servants are lending them money and grain. Please let us leave off of this usury. So Nehemiah is doing all he can. He's just one person. He's not extremely wealthy, apparently, but he's doing what he can to try to help his own countrymen here, that their countrymen, their own brothers and sisters, relatives, and so on, have sold them with these usury principles. Now, please, give back to them this very day their fields, their vineyards, their olive groves, and their houses, everything that they'd use for interest.
Sounds like gouging, you know, today, doesn't it?
Sounds like what?
Gouging.
Yeah, it's really, that's what it is. Usury is a form of gouging. So he's trying to get his own people, the Jews, to stop charging overly for the loans and stuff that they're doing, that they're making. Give them back this very day their fields, their vineyards, their olive groves, their houses, and the hundredth part of the money and of the grain, the new wine and the oil that you're exacting from them. So stop that. Stop charging them unusually high interest for the loans that you're making them and so on. And the people responded well. All right, we'll give it back. We will require nothing from them, verse 12. We will do exactly as you say. So I called the priests and I took an oath from them and that they would do according to this promise. It seems like it's almost a shame that God has to recruit a guy from the Persian Empire, 900 miles away, and send him down there to his people in Jerusalem and Judah to persuade him to stop overcharging their own countrymen, their own family members, and so on with these ridiculous interest rates. Why couldn't somebody there step up like Nehemiah? Got to go get a guy 900 miles away and bring him down? I guess if the hearts of the people there was as it appears to be, yes, the answer is yes, you had to do that. I also shook out the front of my garment and said, thus may God shake out every man from his house and from his possessions who does not fulfill this promise. In other words, if you guys don't keep your promise to stop charging this usury, I hope God shakes you out of the nation and shakes your pockets dry. Even thus may he be shaken out and emptied. And all the assembly said, amen. So at least the response is positive. And they praised the Lord, and the people did according to this promise. So he not only has to try to organize the rebuilding of the wall, he's kind of organizing the rebuilding of Jewish society, knocking off some of this punitive usury stuff that they're doing to each other so that people can pay their taxes and grow their crops and all this kind of stuff. So they had created, in essence, a system of economic stress. I'm going to think it's kind of around the time of the building of the wall here, even though it's not specifically delineated. But at any rate, that looks like the case. Moreover, verse 14, from the day that I was appointed to be their governor in the land of Judah, from the 20th year of the 32nd year of King Artaxerxes, for 12 years, neither I nor my kinsmen have eaten the governor's food allowance. Look, as your governor, I can ask you people to supply me with food. As a governor, you Jews, fellow countrymen, you owe me an allowance to eat on. But I didn't take that allowance from you. For 12 years, you didn't feed me anything. I didn't take your money. I didn't take your food. I didn't add to your burdens during the 12 years that I was governor here. But the former governors who were before me laid burdens on the people and took from them bread and wine, besides 40 shekels of silver. Even their servants domineered the people. But I did not do so because of the fear of God. So Nehemiah forsakes what was due him as the governor to lessen the burden on the people. Nehemiah is wearing a white hat in all of this, isn't he? He's a good guy. This guy is what we, in the, if he was living in the New Testament era, we might call him a Christian gentleman. And not only is he helping the people, he's spending the money out of his own pocket to try to help them and so on. He is a good guy. And God had to go get him from 900 miles away. Apparently no good guys hanging around Jerusalem at this time. And he did that because of his love for and respect for God. And I also applied myself with the work on this wall. Hey, I laid some bricks too, guys. I carried some of those stones myself. We did not buy any land, and all my servants were gathered there for the work. So all my household, in effect, my servants, they're there building on the wall too, along with me. What community don't need some Nehemiahs? Everyone can use a guy like that, can't we? A good organizer of labor, a generous and kind individual, a patriot, a man who spent out of his own pocket to try to help his countrymen and so on. I'm looking forward to meeting this guy someday. He's the kind of guy I'd like to know. Moreover, there were at my table 150 Jews and officials besides those who came to us from the nations that were around us. So besides his political duties and so on, he fed 150 people a day. I guess he kind of rotated around or whatever, did the best he could. So with what he did have, he's trying to help. That's a pretty big table in 150 people. Now that which was prepared for each day was one ox, ate a whole ox, every day. That's pretty good eating. Six sheep, birds. Every 10 days, all sorts of wine was furnished in abundance. Yet for all this, I did not demand the governor's food allowance because the servitude was heavy on the people. He paid for that out of his own personal money. He did not take what was due him as the governor. And so he asks God to remember him. Verse 19, for good, according to all that I've done for this people. And I don't think God would forget him in a second. So he was kind, helpful. He did all he could. He was good at organizing and overseeing this labor that was going on, and he tried to help as much as he could in the economic distress of the day. This is a good guy. So, things are going on, and the enemy is not stopping. Again, as I say before, we would be somewhat naive to think they would be. So they keep on trying to demoralize and discourage the Jews as best they can. They tried mockery, that didn't work. They tried conspiracy, that didn't work. They tried extortion, that didn't work. So now they're going to try to kill the guy. Verse 1, chapter 6. It came about when it was reported to Sanballat, Tobiah the Gershim and Arab, and excuse me, to Gishim the Arab and to the rest of the enemies, that I had rebuilt the wall and that no breach remained in it, although at that time I had not set up the doors and the gates. So they got this thing pulled together. One end of this wall has met the other end of the wall, and there are gates at all of the gates. He just hasn't put the doors in the gates yet, so you can still come and go. So when they'd realized they'd made that kind of progress, Sanballat the rat and Geshem sent a message to me saying, come, let us meet together at this place, Sepharim, or something like that, in the plain of Ono. But they were planning to harm me. He knows that this invitation to meet at this outlying place somewhere is to assassinate the guy. Nehemiah knows that. He's no dummy. So I send messengers to them saying, I'm doing a great work. I cannot come down. Why should the work stop while I leave it and come down to you? And they sent messages to me four times in this manner, and I answered them in the same way. So they're trying to use the threat to, well, he knows it's a threat, to kill the guy and to get him in a place where they can do that, and he refused to go. Well, let's try a little slander since nothing else is working. Sanballat sent his servant to me in the same manner a fifth time with an open letter in his hand. And it was written, it is reported among the nations, and Gashmu says that you and the Jews are planning to rebel. Therefore, you are rebuilding the wall, and you are to be their king according to these reports. And you have also appointed prophets to proclaim in Jerusalem concerning you, a king is in Judah. Have you seen any of that going on? Ah, these lion dogs. And now it will be reported to the king according to these records. So come now, let us take counsel together. We're going to send this letter to the king and say that you're going to rebel against him. You've even got prophets proclaiming you to be the king in Judah. We got all that stuff, they say. Then I sent a message to him saying, such things as you are saying have not been done, but you're inventing them in your own mind. For all of them were trying to frighten us, thinking they will become discouraged with the work and will not be done. But now, O God, strengthen my hands. So he sees through it, and that doesn't work. They can slander him all they want to. He's not going to pay any attention to it. So they try again to get him out somewhere where they can kill him off. And when I entered the house of Shemaiah, the son of somebody else, who was confined at home, he said, let us meet together in the house of God within the temple, and let us close the doors of the temple, for they're coming to kill you, and they're coming to kill you at night. Well, what's this guy tried to do? He tried to get Nehemiah to come to the temple and go inside the holy place and lock it up. That'd be a good safe place for him. What's wrong with that plan? Nobody can go in there. That's what's wrong with the plan. Nobody can access that except the high priest one day a year, and in the outer court, the daily priest. But I said back, should a man like me flee, and could one such as I go to the temple and save his life? I will not go in. And I perceived that surely God had not sent him. But he uttered his prophecy against me because Tobiah and Sanballat had hired him. Sounds like Balaam at work here, doesn't it? He plays for pay. This guy, this priest, plays for pay. He'd been hired by God's enemies to try to sucker Nehemiah into the temple area where they could kill him. He was hired for this reason, that I might become frightened and act accordingly and sin, so that they might have an evil report in order that they could reproach me. So he didn't fall for that trap either. Mockery, conspiracy, extortions, compromise, slander, and treachery, none of that worked. Remember, O my God, Tobiah and Sanballat according to these works of theirs, and also Noadiah the prophetess and the rest of the prophets who were trying to frighten me. So all of those different satanic attempts to shut this rebuild down did not work because of the character of Nehemiah. He saw through this nonsense. He knew what was going on here. So God put the right man at work on this job, didn't he? Again, it's striking that he had to come from where he did to help his own people in Judah, 900 miles away. Well, how did it all work out, I wonder? Well, verse 15 says, so the wall was completed on the 25th day of the month Elul in 52 days. 52 days, these parallel teams put this sucker back together, got the height up to where it's supposed to be, got all the gates reset and the doors in the gates. I don't know how high it was. Again, I'm going to guess it's something like 10, 12, 15 feet at most, something like that probably. 52 days. I bet... Amazing. What's that?
That's pretty amazing.
It is, isn't it? I bet it took longer than that the first time they built it. Because they probably didn't use the same approach that Nehemiah used, a parallel effort on all fronts. And clearly, the people joined the team. There's no mention in this narrative of anybody being paid. These are volunteers. These are people who are willing to go in there and work that hot, dusty stuff all day long, get those stones. I don't know where they got the stones. They must have had some sub-teams out gathering up stones from somewhere, because not all of them would be reusable. Somebody had to get the lumber and cut them beams and stuff and fit the gates before they could even make a door through it. All of that got done in 52 days. That has to be one of the more impressive building projects that we have a record of anywhere. Considering the time frame and the tools and how this thing would progress, striking. Apparently not. Why would they be? I mean, you're recruiting whoever's willing to work, the high priest and his family. And they got one guy's daughters was working on one of the gates. I'm sure they weren't professional wall builders. See, now this is a very, very impressive thing. Now, we saw in the book of Esther how the divine providence oversees the affairs of men. In this case, it was men who built the wall, but somehow or another, I think God must have instilled in them an attitude, a willingness to work hard and to do this kind of thing so that they got the most out of them. So it was a combined effort between God's servants and God who got this thing done. I don't think it could have been done without God's providential care and oversight. And it wouldn't have got done if there hadn't been willing people to work in this behalf, to serve God in this way. So it came about when all our enemies heard it and all the nations surrounding us saw it, they lost their confidence, for they recognized that this work had been accomplished with the help of our God. They know that it's a superhuman feat to do this, and that God is behind the part that men couldn't do. In those days, many letters went from the nobles of Judah to Tobiah, and to Tobiah's letters to him. For many in Judah were bound by oath to him because he was the son-in-law of this guy, the son of Arah and son of Jehoiachin, and had married the daughter of this other guy. So this enemy of theirs is sort of intertwined with some of a Jewish social life through marriage and family and so on and so forth. Moreover, they were speaking about good deeds in my presence and reported my words to him. Then Tobiah sent letters to frighten me. So this guy is still around, still being a nuisance and a pain. Now it came about when the wall was rebuilt and I had set up the doors and gatekeepers and the singers and the Levites were appointed, that I put Hananiah, or Hanani, my brother, and Hananiah, the commander of the fortress, in charge of Jerusalem, for he was a faithful man and feared God more than many. So he does have some help here. He can use his brother. Then I said to them, do not let the gates of Jerusalem be open until the sun is hot. Don't open any gates early in the day. Wait until late morning, around noonish time, then open the doors and the gates. And while they are standing guard, let them shut and bolt the doors, and in the evenings and so on. Also appoint guards from the inhabitants of Jerusalem, each at his own post and each in front of his own house. So anybody that had a house built in Jerusalem, he could also serve as a guard of the place. Because the city was large and spacious, but the people in it were few and the houses were not built. So it's a big open space to try to guard, and there's not a lot of houses built in it or things of that sort. So it's a difficult thing to do, but Nehemiah appointed them, nevertheless, guards to guard this whole place. So everything now is built and guarded. You can see why his enemies are not happy. He's pulled one over right under their noses with God's help. So now they make a registry of this work. I suspect that the Jews at some point in time might be interested in this registry. I don't know of any particular interest to us as Gentiles, but in their family histories, they probably can benefit from knowing this. So God put into my heart to assemble the nobles, the officials, and the people to be enrolled in by genealogies. Then I found the book of the genealogy of those who came up the first, which I had found following the following record. This is Ezra's genealogy in verse 6 and following. And so that's what they've got. They've gone down through all of these people who helped with the wall, and they've got this thing all built and traced back to Ezra's people that came back with him. So get down to verse 73. Now the priests, the Levites, the gatekeepers, the singers, some of the people, the temple servants, and all Israel lived in their cities. And when the seventh month came, the sons of Israel were in their cities. So they've rebuilt all this area around the wall, some of it inside the wall, some of the people were living outside the wall in their houses and so on there. But it was now a fortress where people could live in safety and do, in most part, not only to the grace of God, but to the leadership of this guy, Nehemiah. Good guy. He kind of fits in that Moses camp, doesn't he? Leader of people, good guy, cared about godly principles, tried to live by them. He was the right man for this job. Now, we'll knock off here this morning. What's going to happen next is they're going to kind of renew the Mosaic Covenant and recommit to it and sort of put a bow on this effort. It's mostly done from our perspectives, but a little bit more detail we'll look at forward through with this book. Anybody have any questions or comments about this guy, Nehemiah? Don't hear a whole lot about him. I mean, you don't hear much about the post-exilic history of Israel to begin with, but if you do, you have to hear about Nehemiah because he was a major player in all of that. Three different waves back, three different restorations. He was the head of one of them. The first one had to do with rebuilding the temple. Finally got it done after 20 years. Ezra decides later he's going to come back and try to help the spiritual condition of the people, which he did. We don't know how much. We all we saw was one problem he worked. And in the third wave, Nehemiah wanted to come back and build the wall when he hears that it's still in rubble and in shambles since Nebuchadnezzar tore it down 150 years earlier. Those are the three primary waves back in the post-exilic history of Israel. A big parenthesis is the book of Esther and how God's sovereign protection of his people works, even if they are not paying any attention to him. Ezra's focus was on their spiritual needs. That was important. And Nehemiah provided great leadership, not only in a secular mode of building a wall, but spiritually as well in getting the people to stop taking advantage of each other through usury principles. So those are our three main waves back over a period of about 100 years or so. Let's say from 536 down to 444. So about that 70, let's see, it was actually 92 years from the first wave to kind of the last one. And from there, then the city would be able to safely grow. With the wall around it, you could live in it, or you could live close enough to it that you could take refuge in the city if you needed to. So by the time you get down to the end of Nehemiah's work, it is a viable capital of Judaism again that the people could live in. So after the exile, it took about 100 years, let's say, to kind of get it back to normal functioning type stuff, about 100 years worth of time. Didn't happen overnight, did it? Yes, sir?
I got curious about your question because I've always heard about the Wailing Wall.
Oh, okay.
And I seem to find a reference that the Wailing Wall is the only remaining wall of the Second Temple. So when you see in that diagram you had up, I think that square in the middle of the area on the north.
Yeah, yeah.
May represent the temple. The only remaining wall of that, between B and C, the only remaining wall of that neighborhood is the
wall. Yeah, this artist shows it kind of a little thing sticking up over here. I don't know if it's really here, if it's against the wall or what.
Is this shows it the same way in the Amplified Bible, it shows it in the same diagram. Right,
yeah, if you go search on this stuff, most of the authors will give you this picture you got right here. Now, I don't know where they get their information. The excavation records, of course, help some. And the old city down there to the south is where David lived. And see these numbers here? This 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. This stuff here, all along this area here. What they think that is, up here at the top, is a... Where there's some of the old David era was and lived.
You know, in that narrow part called the city of David.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. This Ophel down here was during David's time. I don't know anything about this. I'm just taking what I can get my hands on. If anybody's been there, you may have a better concept in mind of what this whole thing's about. But I've not been there, and I'm just grabbing up stuff I can get off of the internet or from commentaries. But that's what you usually find. It's an odd looking, sort of an odd looking wall toward the south down there, isn't it? Pretty narrow. And I don't see anybody giving us any square acreage or how big it is, how big it was. So, but it's a decent reference to kind of following the narrative and so on. I mean, we can use it even if it isn't precise.
They claim that the Europeans were the ones who named it the Wailing Wall because they saw the Jews weeping.
The Europeans named that?
Yeah, there wasn't really a Jewish reference. It was an external reference to the Jews who were...
Yeah, the Wailing Wall is not part of this outside wall thing. I'm kind of stating... It's actually the base, the foundational base of the temple mount area. And most of that was kind of built by Herod, really, when he enlarged the temple and redid the second temple. But it's part of the whole just base structure of that temple, and that's all that's left because Jesus said that it was only the breakdown of the actual temple.
They've not been able to find one stone from that temple that was marked a temple stone. What he said was that not one stone will be found on top of the other. The whole temple will be destroyed, and they think maybe the Romans carried them all out and dumped them in the Mediterranean. The excavators have not discovered one temple stone in all these years of excavating over there.
And they don't care to rebuild another.
Yeah, they're going to...
the Jews want to rebuild the third temple, for sure.
They'll rebuild the... During the tribulation period, they will have one that they've rebuilt. Some people say, well, they're compiling materials to do that now. And so when the tribulation period starts, they can do it quickly, that they have stones and woods and stuff like that to do that quickly. I don't know about that, but if so, they probably will, because it will be in use when the Antichrist disrupts its use at the midpoint of the tribulation period. So they'll be using it for 3.5 years, and then he says, oh, this is going to be my place now. So it will be up again after... it's tore up again, and then the Lord will build the last one in the millennium, and he'll oversee that one. He'll be the Nehemiah of that building project, and it will be big. That is a big, the temple in the millennium is very large.
So does the next temple have to be built before Christ returns?
Yeah, there will be one in the tribulation period. He comes back at the end of the tribulation period, wipes out everybody that's there and starts the millennial kingdom, and then he builds this new one. And the gates of the new one, I think, are like 90 feet tall. There's three of them, I believe. Maybe a fourth one. I can't remember. But it's
You're talking about the Ezekiel vision.
Yeah.
There's just three...
Three gates.
Three gates.
Yeah, that's what I'm remembering, too.
Three outer gates and three inner gates, but they mirror each other. There's not a fourth gate.
90 feet tall, man. I mean, that is a gate. Who gets to put the stones on the top of that sucker? Some people to whom?
You know, really, the most important thing about Nehemiah was Nehemiah is fulfilling what Daniel said in chapter 79, about the 70 weeks. Because 70 weeks couldn't, and the coming of Christ couldn't be there until they rebuilt the city. So that's what the important part of Nehemiah was, that they rebuilt it, but that declaration that, yes, you can rebuild the city wall, not the temple for some odd reason, but for the city itself, is what starts that whole 70-week thing.
Yeah, well, see, the temple's already rebuilt. Zerubbabel got that going. So there's no temple to be rebuilt at Nehemiah's time. He's just trying to get the city to function again by getting the wall up, and they can start building houses in it and things of that sort.
But I mean, it was interesting that Daniel's vision was that it was not from when they finally were going to get around to rebuilding the second temple, but when they actually rebuilt the walls and around the city of Jerusalem.
And the Romans came along and said, well, thank you very much. We'll just tear this one down for you. Herod built on it for like 40-some-odd years, adding to the things, and the Romans wiped it off the face of the earth. But they will build another one at the start of the tribulation period. All right.
Go put on the feedback.
Yeah, that's right. That sounds like a plan and a half. Bob, where you want us to congregate somewhere, just kind of in the hallway there by the...
Just the hallway, we just meet there, and they tell them that you're at my table, and they'll make a way to seat you.
Oh, okay, okay.
My reservation's for 12 o'clock, and you don't have time to go wash your hands and everything that you want to
do. We'll do that, and we'll be over there by noon. Okay, and we'll be looking for you.
Okay, I'll be there.
All right.
Do you know anybody else that you would like to have come in?
I can't find Rose. I'll look for her when we leave here, but I've told her ahead of time, and she seemed interested, but haven't seen her.